We met at the Social Emotional Learning Conference in Harrisburg.
Yes.
And you facilitated a session on racial literacy, cultural responsiveness, and how to become more aware and awake educators.
Mm-hmm.
I left that moved and inspired, and I wanted to talk to you more. And I reached out to you, and you fortunately said you'd be willing to talk more. What struck me about it was just your ability to bring everybody together. And if you looked at that room, we were all different hues, all different ages, different genders, non-binary. It was really a mixed group that
mm-hmm.
came. And it was really a sensitive subject, and what you did was so much fun.
Oh, thank you.
It really was really, really moving. And I have so many questions out of that.
Hopefully I have answers.
Yeah, well, we'll talk about them. The questions, I think, are just going to be jumping off point.
Okay.
When I thought about talking with you, I thought, well, you stood up, you, of course, knew roughly what you were going to say, but you looked out at that audience, and everyone looked so different. And when you walk into a room and you're about to take people into this journey, unpacking our ideas and constructs of race, our experiences, people who have maybe never thought about it, or people who have never been able to unpack and process this, who aren't sure if it's a safe environment,
mm-hmm.
or who have no idea that there are landmines they're about to walk into. What are the first impressions that you take in?
I always want to have people at ease, because you can't have these challenging conversations when you're on the defense. You know, and so I think whenever I look around, when I walk in, it's like, okay, let me get a sense of my audience in some way. But then it's also trying to notice how people are responding.
Mm-hmm.
And so I don't know. I think I opened up the session with a video of teachers giving students compliments. And so I try to, from the beginning, create an atmosphere that is inclusive, because if we're going to do this work, we need to do it together. And so, and what we're talking about is not alienating students and not alienating our faculty members and our team. So then I need to be modeling that in that space.
Great. What do you take in? What are the cues that you look around for?
I look around to see clusters of people, you know, to see if people have come in a group and are sitting together, phones and notebooks and laptops. You know, are people coming in just to kind of like be in the room because they have to,
mm-hmm.
or are they coming in to try to really engage and connect? I look around to see the different ages. Sometimes I'll ask, you know, what people's backgrounds are. But that, I mean, it's like I'm really just looking to see, like, who's my audience? How are they positioning themselves in the room? Do we have people sitting up front? Is everyone kind of lingering in the back? And those give me senses of, like, how comfortable people are with the content.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when people are more comfortable, they tend to gather near me because they don't feel like I'm going to swat them or something. But when it's like they're not as sure, I end up with two rows of empty seats, and then people will fill in, and then the late people end up having to sit in the front. So those are the kinds of things
or stand,
right?
You took us through an exercise where you listed a number of things, and I don't remember exactly how it went, but you more or less got us to keep taking out identifications
mm-hmm.
and see what the primary one
mm-hmm.
we were left with. I found that really interesting and really revealing. And I was aware, or at least I projected, that if I was one of the other people in the room, different gender or different skin color, I would have answered that differently.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I call it peeling the onion, because the idea is like we're just kind of taking the layers off. And every group has a different reaction to that activity. You know, some people, like today, someone was like, why are we doing this? You know, and other people are just like, let's see what happens because this is getting uncomfortable. And other people are like, that was no problem. I'm a Christian. I could have said that from the beginning. Or I identify as a woman. I could have said that right out of the gate, like without any effort. So, but there's also that struggle of just kind of removing and unpacking and then reminding our adults that we do this to each other and we do it to kids. You know, we have this tendency to want to just kind of put folks in boxes. And so that's why I like to do that activity for ourselves, because we can't have that dialogue with ourselves and it's harder to take it out to other spaces.
What struck me when I did it is my primary identification came that I couldn't be without, which I hadn't realized so much, was being a woman. And it was something that growing up, I spent a lot of time pushing against. I didn't want to be defined as a woman because that meant limitation to me. I wanted to be free. I wanted to be able to travel. I wanted to be able to go anywhere I wanted and do anything I wanted, regardless of the fragility of my gender and the lack of safety. So I, at a young age, before I knew better, because I still had that adolescent brain that didn't really register danger, I did things that, you know, my adult self.
High risk.
Yeah. That I, my adult self, you know, fortunately I was protected and, you know, bad things that could have happened didn't happen, but I wouldn't want the teenagers I teach to insist that there was no gender difference because there really is. And of course, as an adolescent, I experienced the fear and just insisted that I wasn't going to let that stop me. And that what struck me as we did that exercise, I realized that working off, pushing off against that identity defined my life more than I thought.
Yeah.
Race wasn't something that particularly defined me, or so I thought. And it was only more recently as I realized that a lot of the things that I did, I was able to do because I was white-skinned, never occurred to me. Because that was that invisible kind of, you know, card that I could use to walk through the world, And I, but that wasn't like one of the defining characteristics that was obvious to me. Because it opened doors, not closed doors.
And oftentimes people identify something that isn't necessarily obvious. That exercise helps people to kind of think about this in ways that they had not thought about before. Distilling down to a single identity is like, whoa, I never considered the fact that this is where I feel the most connected. This is one piece of it. And you could do it in a much larger scale and you may not end up there. But yeah, the takeaway is similar for a lot of people, where they weren't expecting necessarily when it started that that's where it would end.
Interesting. Do you find that that people of color more often identify race as the final defining characteristic?
No. I find that the things that come out are race and gender. Those are the two things that resonate with people. Age is the first thing everyone wants to get rid of, which I found to be interesting working with a younger group of people. They too were like, whoop, by age and within the first two. But most people end up with race or gender. And then there's this other thread of religion or spiritual affiliation that, and I've noticed that in different parts of the country, that one becomes more prevalent in different regions of the country.
Very interesting. So as we start developing racial literacy, so understanding what racial stress moments are, understanding where we are in life in relationship to privilege and lack of privilege or exclusion, and also race, it's important to begin to understand how we identify ourselves, because we don't go through exercises like that.
Yeah. Normally. Yeah. And it's important for other people to start to understand how you identify, because we often impose those things on other people, but we don't give folks an opportunity to say, no, my blackness is first who I am, or my education is first who I am.
Mm-hmm.
We just fill in the blanks, and then we engage with people based on those blanks that we have filled in.
And without them knowing.
Without them knowing, often.
And I may choose a different way to define you
exactly.
than you would choose to define yourself.
Exactly.
And I assume that, because that's the most obvious thing to mm-hmm. me about you, I'm assuming that that's the most obvious thing about you to mm-hmm. you also.
Absolutely. And so what I would connect with you on is, like, our first common ground is we're both women.
Mm-hmm.
And then we care about kids. And we want them to have successful and warm and loving, engaging experiences in school. And so how we approach that work is different, but that is a space that we both occupy,
mm-hmm.
you know? And so, but had I not spoken with you, I wouldn't have known that. You would have
right.
just been a participant, a woman participant in my thing.
And you would have known that we're both women.
Yeah. And that would have been the extent, possibly.
And you would have known that we had some interest in the subject matter unless
mm-hmm.
I was forced to do that.
Right, exactly. Or you were there for just the learning part because you had to.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I have an interesting issue with the race, because it's a construct.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And most people don't really know that, but race was made up. And it was made up primarily by two individuals who more or less got their anthropology degrees from the back of a matchbook, quite literally, thanks to Joy DeGruy's research and enlightening me. And she's certainly somebody who's influenced me a lot.
Yes.
She does extraordinary work.
Absolutely.
And realizing that, you know, this black, brown, yellow, and red racial identity was made up by two individuals for their own ends and has no basis in
anything,
biology, in genetics, in culture at all. Once I kind of awoke to that fact, talking about racial literacy or racial divides bothers me.
Mm-hmm.
I don't mind talking about issues of privilege and exclusion and skin color, but identifying something as race and perpetuating that as if it were a bona fide characteristic now doesn't sit well with me. And I'm wondering how you navigate that.
Yes, I agree. So when we are able to talk about race, one of the things I like to say is that there's just one, right? And it's human. That's our race. And that everything else is our ethnicity, our nationality. There are these other words that we can use to describe why our skin color is the way it is, our hair texture and things like that. And so our culture that we grew up with, or the culture that we're creating in new spaces.
Mm-hmm.
So the idea of talking about race is sometimes a difficult space to navigate, because I believe that we only have one race. And I understand that race is a social construct that has changed and evolved over time to elevate whiteness. So the definition of white has changed in our country over the course of centuries, you know, and it,
can you give an example of that?
Yeah.
That's going to be challenging
yeah.
for a lot of people to think about.
One example was, like, in the late 1800s, there was a doctor, and I can send you a reference for this, but there was a doctor who was from India. And at that point, the characteristics around race were really physical characteristics, right? Your nose shape, your hair color, your build, because we're talking
your head size,
right? Because we're talking about Africans and European folks and Native Americans. And so there was a doctor from India who came to the United States and was trying to either get a license or start his business, because he was considered white based on the criteria at that time for what whiteness was. So when they were reviewing the stuff and he came to, like, testify or whatever to defend his request, they just changed the rules. So they denied it, and then they changed what they categorize as being white. A more recent example is in the 40s and 50s, you know, neighborhoods were separated by ethnic groups. So there were Italian communities, the Greek community, the Irish community, and there was a hierarchy within those communities in how people were perceived. And certain groups were considered like the dogs of that, of whiteness, until there became kind of like this movement. And so it was like, well, we have to gather together so that we can prevent these brown and black people from being elevated. So the idea of whiteness changing and evolving is that, like, there are these rules. This is what it is to be white. But as those rules become, because they're not founded on anything, as those rules become challenged, then we just change the definition so that we can maintain that level of privilege, mm-hmm. and continue to oppress or marginalize these other groups.
Right. It's hard for people to believe now that whiteness has changed, but Irish used to not be considered white.
Right.
And of course, in Boston, you couldn't tell an Irish descent person in Boston that they're not white.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess one of the other aspects about the genetic lack of difference is that you and I may share more genetic coding in common, mm-hmm. than I might share with my family members,
right.
with my blood brother and sister,
mm-hmm.
that they found more genetic diversity and discrepancies between family members than between people of supposedly different
race.
Mm-hmm.
So. Yeah. The idea of race in general, and that because, as you said, it was constructed or created basically based on nothing. And so it's one of those things that gets easily unraveled. But what has then happened is the reinforcement of this notion of what race is, what beauty is in the standards. I say any group that you can make a derogatory racial joke about at some point was not white. Any white group. So there are names for Spanish people, there are names for Italian people, there are names for Irish people, there are names for Polish people. That's because at some point they were not considered part of the in-white group.
Interesting. I mean, it's had such powerful and is having such powerful influence on our contemporary discourse.
Mm-hmm.
But
especially too, since our mixed race communities are growing.
Mm-hmm.
So this notion of what whiteness is becoming even more unclear and convoluted because I'll give an example. My sister is married to a white guy from Wisconsin, and he is very fair complected. He has blue eyes, and she has three children, and they all look different. The oldest one is more olive toned. She has brown hair. She has brown eyes. She's tall and slim. She's only six, but she's very like athletic model-esque, like ballet model build, even in her movements. And then the middle one, she's four. She has blue eyes, blonde hair, very fair complected. And if you saw her out with my brother-in-law, you would not assume that her mother was black. You know, it's like her hair is just kind of wavy. It's not as thick. And she looks more Caucasian, more Anglo. And then my nephew, he's two. He's like kind of right in the middle. His eyes are blue. His hair is brown. You can tell he gets a little bit more color. And so in that household, who are they?
Right.
And they're not just black, because that's not a whole identity of their father is white. His whole family is white. They have that experience on a regular basis. So it's this construct of race is again becoming kind of undermined, because that's not what families look like anymore.
Right. More than we're led to believe.
More than we're led to believe.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. That there is a lot more connection than, you know, what's being, you know, shown in the media.
Yeah.
And that's a painful reality that we're living with today.
Yeah.
And something that, you know, I feel very inspired to deconstruct.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think
mm-hmm.
that there are a lot of things that people believe are more the truth than they really are.
Yes.
That we're more divided,
yes,
than we really are. And but of course, in the institutions, and particularly in the policing and the prisoning, which there's a lot of power and money behind that. There's
private power and money.
Not government power, mm-hmm. but a lot of private power in mm-hmm. the private prison industry,
yeah.
and in the munitions industry that is outfitting government contracts
yeah.
for body armor, weapons, cameras. I mean, it's a multi-billion dollar industry, both
mm-hmm.
of them. And that's defining our policy more than political will, public perception and goals. And it's giving a narrative that is serving to divide.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So that's interesting.
I
wasn't intending to unpack that, but I guess it was a little...
The nature of the dialogue.
Exactly. Interesting. So I guess since we're talking a little bit about what the public perception is, I've noticed that my comfort level talking with people who are different than me and is changing in a couple different ways.
Mm-hmm.
So I traveled a lot. I've probably lived out of the country about 10 years of my life. And I used to love talking to people about their cultures. So you could always tell what was happening geopolitically by the cab drivers in New York. I mean, now that we have Uber, it's a little bit different.
Right.
But you would have immigrants from different nationalities. And I always loved, you know, you get in a cab and you go, whoa, where are you from?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Oh, what's it like? How long have you been here?
Mm-hmm.
And which part of, you know, Ethiopia or mm-hmm. Ghana or Belarus are you from?
Right.
You know, oh, are you from the Punjab? No, are you from Kerala? I never ask now. Because
really?
I'm afraid that if I ask someone where they're from, they're going to be worried that I have an attitude about them being an immigrant, or that they're not welcome here, or that they are, you know, maybe waiting on immigration status,
mm-hmm.
and that I'm afraid that my natural curiosity is going to be perceived as a threat.
Mm.
And I've noticed that I don't ask people anymore.
Wow. I hadn't even considered that. I hadn't considered that at all. I think more about the persistence when you ask someone where they're from. Like, you just gave an example that was actual, genuine interest and curiosity. And I believe that when you ask somebody where they're from and they answer, that that's the direction that the conversation should go. But that's not always the case, you know. So sometimes it goes like, where are you from? What are you doing here? You know, and so it becomes this conversation that then feels adversarial. But how you just described the interaction, it felt very welcoming.
So do you feel when you're with kids in school, because one of the my program, the Inner Strength Foundation, works in Philadelphia Public Schools.
Mm-hmm.
One of the schools that we're going to be in starting in the fall has kids from 27 different countries,
mm-hmm.
speaking 20 different languages. And I like to validate kids'
mm-hmm.
heritage. What's your experience in going into schools with the differences?
I like to ask kiddos where they grew up, and then where their families grew up. Because some students really want to be part of the community. And so their response might be, I grew up 4 blocks from here, even if they've only lived there for 6 months. But then if you say, well, where did your parents grow up or where did your family grow up? You may get a better, a more contextual answer about their experience. Oh, what was that like for them? Have they brought any of those traditions with them to the United States? Do you guys still do, you know, X, Y, or Z? And so it can feel more like not where are you from, because then it could be perceived as, well, you're not from here, so where are you from? Mm. There are people who've lived here for 20 and 30 years who still have heavy accents from their home countries, but they consider themselves to be American because they have citizenship status or whatever it is. So kind of reframing it to get the where did you grow up, where did your family grow up, may help with them giving you the same kind of information that you're looking for to acknowledge it without instilling some of that other angst that is part of the social narrative that exists right now.
Mm-hmm. That's helpful. So where did you grow up? Have you found that kids are interested in talking about their home countries?
Some,
or their parents' home countries?
So I've had some very different experiences. I think when there's a community of people, so it's not just one kid, they are more interested because they feel like they don't have to be the voice for everybody. But when they're, I'll give an example. When I was working in South LA, we had an Asian student. An Asian student.
A single one.
One Asian student. And she told everybody her dad was Mexican, which was not true.
Mm-hmm.
But all of the school was 99.98% Black and Latino, 80% Latino. Of that 80%, 80% Mexican. The other Latino families were from, or Latinx families were from Honduras and El Salvador.
Mm-hmm.
So she was Asian. She had a white father, but she told everyone that she was half Mexican. And she did that because she wanted to fit in.
Fit in. So she didn't speak Spanish.
She didn't speak Spanish. But she did that because she wanted to fit in. And she didn't want to be the only other.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that when we have like a collection or a cohort or a community of folks from a particular area, they're more willing to kind of talk about it because they're not the spokesperson.
Mm-hmm.
But when it's just that one person, I would suggest being more gentle about how you approach it because you don't want them to feel like they're speaking for everyone.
Right.
You know, and that is an experience that a lot of people of color, brown, black, wherever, have. Mm-hmm. That they're the perspective on that.
Right. Which makes them, at a young age, they're carrying something that's mm-hmm. hard to carry.
That's hard to carry and hard to kind of navigate because they don't really understand.
Mm-hmm. In my program, I have a group of teachers, instructors in Philadelphia. And we've been in 12 of the public high schools, which, as you can imagine, are very diverse.
Yeah.
And, you know, they have a range, but mostly in the public schools, the majority of our schools are probably 70% and above people of color, you know, mm-hmm. kids of color. Many different nationalities. Mm-hmm. My teachers, who all have a deep background with mindfulness. Several of them are former school teachers with 17 years experience yeah. in the classroom and interest. Some are psychologists, three are psychologists. One's a retired firefighter.
Nice.
Yeah. They are all white. They're all Caucasian. And the majority of the kids that they work with are not.
Mm-hmm.
They're great teachers, and the kids really respond well to them. And the result has been very moving. At the same time, there's a huge cultural chasm. If you were to work with those teachers or teacher, a room full of teachers just like them, what would be the three things you would feel would be important for them to reflect on, think about, take into account?
Okay, the three things?
Three things.
Come on.
Five.
Come on, Amy. So, one, I would say ask, don't assume.
Can you explain what that is?
Yes. So lots of times we assume things about our kids' experience based on information that we received not from them. That's the abridged version. And so there may be a behavior issue, a attendance issue, something like that. Parents may not be coming to meetings. What we have the tendency of doing is filling in the gaps and assuming why. Oh, this parent doesn't care. This kid isn't interested in learning, whatever. But the reality might be, and this is a real example, that they don't have a hot water heater. And so the kids stop coming to school because they can't take showers. And they're embarrassed to be at school and smell. That might be their reality. But what we're projecting onto them is that they don't care about their education. So that's what I mean by ask, don't assume. Mm-hmm. They might be hungry, and that's why they can't focus. They may have been up taking care of a younger sibling, and that's why they're sleeping in class. They may have been at work because they have to contribute to the household functioning, and that's why they didn't complete their homework. So ask them. And don't assume that there's some malicious intent there for why. So that would be one thing. Oh, man. Can we come back to this one? This is a hard question. Three things. Okay, so ask and assume. Another thing I would recommend is your own inner dialogue. So we do this as teachers. Or as people working with students. And this is a cultural divide.
Mm-hmm.
Amy, are you going to clean up those papers before we leave this classroom, before we leave this meeting? It's a question. It's intended to be an instruction to you to clean up the papers before we leave the classroom. But in families where they receive directives in order to do things, it's perceived as what it is, which is a question.
Mm.
So the answer might be no. And so when that answer is no, then you'd have a situation that then escalates because the response from the teacher is that I told you to do this. But the student's perspective is like, no, you didn't tell me. You asked me to do this. And I said no. And so I've seen this a lot in schools. Where the directive will be framed as a question, and a lot of students who are of different ethnic backgrounds, at home, it's do your homework, get to dinner, take your shower. It is direct instruction. That is a command. That's what they respond to. So if you don't give a command, then they believe that there's flexibility in what you're asking them to do, and they may respond according to how they're feeling, and that can escalate into a behavior issue that actually wasn't a behavior issue. If you had just given an instruction in a different way that they're accustomed to, then you'll get the outcome that you're looking for.
So that, we need a dictionary. We need a cultural competency dictionary.
Yeah, yeah. But this goes back to the ask and don't assume. Because you can then say, well, why did you say no?
Because you asked me, and I don't want
right,
to do
exactly.
it.
Exactly.
I'm 15. I don't want to do that.
Exactly. And that will de-escalate a situation when you do that, mm-hmm. as opposed to assuming that they're being defiant or mm-hmm. disrespectful or non-compliant.
And how do you work to change a culture where the kids are used to more strong directives
mm-hmm.
to one that is more allowing, inclusive?
You have to say it. And say it out loud and help to create. So what it is you have a hidden curriculum that you're expecting the students to be able to understand. And so you have to bring that hidden curriculum to the foreground so that they are learning that when I say this, this is what I mean. And the reason I say it this way is because I want to give you the flexibility to have choices, right? You have to be careful, but I want to give you the flexibility to have choices. I want you to make decisions on your own, because when you leave high school, someone's not going to always be telling you what to do.
I'm going to have to try this with my husband. Maybe there's a communication gap.
But that could be true, you know? But you tell them. So I want you guys to have the freedom to have choices, but here are the expectations that we have in our classroom together. So it's going to be clean. It's going to be this. It's going to be that. But if you're not ready to clean up your papers, I'm not going to get into an argument with you about it, because we have a shared understanding about what the expectation is. And if you're still in the middle of something, even though I want to move on, why do I need to push you on that? I'll let you finish, and then you're going to clean up your papers, and we're going to keep it moving. So that would be the third thing. Unpack the hidden curriculum.
Mm-hmm.
So what did I say?
Ask,
don't assume. What was the second one?
The second one was direct, you know, had to do with cultural differences and lack of understanding, which still goes back to ask, don't assume.
And then,
so when in moments of disagreement, the solution is to ask.
Is to ask.
Assume.
Yep. And unpack that hidden curriculum for sure. Oh man, there are so many things. I think the other thing is, like, be aware of your whiteness.
What does that mean?
So be aware of the fact that your experience is different from your student's experience. And so don't, or try not to impose what your expectations are based on your lived experiences on them, because they have different lived experiences. So you have to recognize that as you drive into their school, past all their houses and whatever, that some of those kids go through a lot to get to school. And so we can't, again, assume or impose that our journey and their journey have been the same. Because you, and I say be aware of your whiteness, because the majority of teachers are white and the majority of your instructors are white.
Mm-hmm.
So that journey that you have to get there is not the same as them. So we need to support them in areas, our students in areas that they may not have support. And that goes back again to ask, don't assume. I feel like that's the main one, mm-hmm. is we need to talk to our kids. We need to connect with our students. We need to know what their experiences are.
So this is a tricky one, because I think the ask, don't assume will probably be the title of this discussion together. Because oftentimes what happens is, if you come from a background of privilege, that you project your experience of going through neighborhoods with a lack of privilege onto those kids.
Mm-hmm.
So for those kids, it's also, this is home.
Right.
This is home. This is where I grew up. This is where mom is. This is where I have fun. This mm-hmm. is where bad things happen to. But this is home.
This is home. This is what I
this
know.
This is home. I'm comfortable here, even if I'm afraid sometimes. Mm-hmm. But this is home. So mm-hmm. I don't, as a child who grows up in those neighborhoods, they may not
have the same sense.
Have the same, oh my God, this is unsafe, it's dilapidated, why is it so unattractive, why can't the city do something about this, why aren't there trees, why aren't there all the things that, if you come from a neighborhood of more affluence, you drive through those neighborhoods and those are the things that strike you, but that may not be the experience of the kids.
Because they don't have often anything to compare it to, because this is just home. So they're not coming from the suburbs and coming through here. This has been their reality for the time that they've been on Earth. I had students who had never been to the beach, and the beach was 6 miles away from their community. They knew that neighborhood, and that's it. And I, so you know, a group of us, we took a bunch of kids to the beach. But they didn't know what they were missing until they had the opportunity, the access to it.
Mm-hmm.
And then students were realizing, like, A, this isn't that far, and, like, there's so much going on here, you know? And so our teachers need to have that understanding that you just described, that this is their lived experience. So don't diminish it. Don't make it ugly or mean, because they go back home to that you're calling ugly. That's what they live in. So when you're doing that, you're also talking about them.
Mm-hmm. Ask them.
Ask, don't assume.
And how would you help teachers like mine and other teachers who have more privilege learn how to ask, not assume? Because that our assumptions are so deeply embedded in how we are and how the culture is, that we're not, it's very hard to objectify those touch points where there's an assumption.
Mm-hmm.
How do you begin to do that?
So one of the things I tell people all the time is, when you have evidence that what you believe is the rule is not true, change the rule in your mind. Meaning, when you have evidence that all Asian people are not good at math and science, then you need to change that rule in your mind, right? That they're not all a model minority. And that is where people really struggle.
Mm.
It's so, I think it's about changing that internal dialogue, because I can't always be the exception. I can't always be the person who's not like them. Them who? That's where I would tell people to start, is you have evidence in the schools that you're working in of excellence, of commitment, of engagement. So don't let anyone tell you that Black children can't learn and that they can't meditate. Period. Your students are not the exception. They should be the rule.
Mm-hmm. When you think about, you know, some of the students of color and what they're carrying with them, how do you help teachers support them through the things that they can't see? So, for example, my parents are children of immigrants.
Mm-hmm.
All four of my grandparents came over between the First World War and the Second World War from a part of Poland, which was sometimes Poland, sometimes Russia, depending on who was invading who.
Mm-hmm.
And all four of my grandparents were Jewish, and their villages were often burned.
Mm-hmm.
So my grandfather actually came over. My great-grandfather dropped the two kids off in an orphanage in the South, in Atlanta. There were orphanages for Jewish children from Europe, mm-hmm. which were war camps, and mm-hmm. he picked cotton in the
mm-hmm.
orphanage.
Wow.
And my great-grandfather disappeared. Everyone thinks he was just a gambler and got rid of the kids and left.
Right.
Nobody ever saw him again.
Mm-hmm.
My grandfather was a night janitor in a grade school. And my mother put herself through college and graduate school.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, not many years after.
Mm-hmm.
My father's side, similar story.
Mm-hmm.
Scrap metal shop in L.A. My dad went to Columbia grad school, got a Ph.D. in physics.
Mm-hmm.
Both of my parents carried with them growing up in the, you know, post-depression. They were both born in 1930. They carried with them the fears and superstition and kind of inherited trauma from their grandparents. And even though their life was relatively comfortable, you would think that we hadn't moved very far from my grandparents. So I can see how cultural inherited trauma in them.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, the post-Holocaust has been studied, probably more so than any other genocide, and the effect of intergenerational trauma.
Mm-hmm.
How do we help educators deal with the intergenerational trauma that most kids of color have experienced, whether they're new immigrants or whether they're black children who've lived in, you know, whose families go back to the civil, you know, prior to the Civil War.
Right. So first, we have to acknowledge the historical experience. Not everybody wants to do that. And that's true for the Holocaust as well, right? Mm-hmm. There are people who want to act like that never happened, or that there was a choice of some sort, you know? So first, it's that acknowledgement that this took place, that this very significant, ongoing, non-war-related trauma took place to an entire group of people based on their color. If we can't acknowledge that, then none of the other work can be done. The other piece is all of our students don't have the sophistication to understand why their experience is what their experience is. So we, as the adults, have to be cautious at when we're trying to have these kind of dialogues, because we may be putting something into their minds that is not actually there yet. So,
or that they don't have the tools to
or they don't have the tools to work with or unpack. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I think we need to understand the historical context of what happens and the implications. And then we, whether we do it explicitly or more implicitly, have to not repeat that. But if we can't acknowledge and kind of understand and see how things have gotten to where they are, then we can't address those issues and think about how we can undo or course correct or change our behavior so that that doesn't have to continue to be the experience.
Can we just do that by caring about the kids and wishing them well?
No.
Why not? Or what do we need to do then?
So the reason I say no when I say it so quickly is because there is such clear data that certain groups of kids, particularly brown and black kids, are having this experience at a much higher level than other students of color. So we can't just love on them, which is important. We need to. But we need to understand the systems that have created their experience. Mm-hmm. And we need to be actively working against those systems. And so loving on them is not actively working against those systems, because when we do that, we're picking and choosing who we love on, oftentimes, based on our affinity to them, based on our connection to them. You know, we love all of our children, but I love them the most. Mm-hmm. You know, we do that. And so it's not about them as individuals. It's about the system in which they're placed. And so how do we deconstruct that system so that we can really have a positive impact on their outcomes and achievement?
So you said a lot in that. What if we're not activists and we don't, you know, we don't want to go out and march, and we don't want to be involved in the harsh political discourse, and you're saying as teachers that we can't just love our kids, that we need to engage with this discussion. How do we do that without taking on a whole persona or milieu that isn't what called us to educate in the first place?
So, I mean, there are lots of different ways. One could be, you know, let's not wear t-shirts to school that might marginalize a whole group of kids. You know, like, oh, I love all of my students, but I'm wearing this t-shirt that has a connotation or a message that that doesn't make them feel good. You know, like, again, we have to understand the history around their experiences so that we can really start to deconstruct. It's not necessarily about activism and marching. If you have time in a classroom, you can create a space in your classroom or in your school building that stops sending students to jail. You don't have to be outside holding a sign for that. You can choose to work your PBIS steps or have a center in your room where people can calm down. You can choose to create a space where students see themselves in their work,
where they see themselves in the literature and in the history, where you're bringing in supplementary materials that help to reframe and illuminate for them how historically their ancestors have come here and what that experience may have been like. You can just make a decision that sending people to the principal is a last, absolutely last resort. That what happens in your space, you guys are co-constructing. And so that can change the trajectory of a whole child's experience beyond just loving on them, giving them tools to be successful outside of your classroom space by giving them power in your space, giving them rights to the space, helping them feel engaged. Like, this isn't Ms. Hamilton Biaris's classroom. This is all of our space. And what happens in this space belongs to all of us. And that can change for them. It's not a bragging thing, but I didn't like to call security because I wanted us to work out any kind of challenges we were having in the classroom, because that's what life is. You can't always just call the police, or you shouldn't. Because if we have a disagreement, we should be able to have a dialogue about that. And if we can help to teach our students that, okay, you were fighting, I have broken you up. Why were you fighting? Do I need to write them up? I often chose not to. And so when I called, everybody came because it was obviously something significant, right? But it was like, why are we fighting? What are we trying to accomplish? When I think it was like 2007-ish, and then I'll stop talking, but okay. It was like 2007-ish, and there was an immigration bill in California, and I was teaching a 10th grade English class, and my students were talking about walking out. There was a high school that was literally like across, you could see it from our parking lot, and they walked out, and they came to our school to collect the students from our school who were walking out. And so I said to the students, they're like, well, Miss So-and-so said that we can walk out. And I said, okay, well, you need to be able to tell me where you're going, why you're going there, and what you hope to accomplish. If you cannot answer those three questions, then you're truant. And none of my kids left. But it was because it was like, and then we had a dialogue about it. But it wasn't, you're not just going to go and ditch school and say it's because for a cause. If you want to contribute to the cause, it needs to start right here. So my responsibility is to help you understand what's happening, why it's happening, and the role that you can play. And then if you choose to walk out to the Capitol to in protest of this law that you think is unjust, then you are welcome to leave. But that's what we need to do for our kids, I think.
Educate them
beyond loving on them. Educate them in the ways of the world.
Mm.
So partly one of the things that you're talking about is being able to understand cultural differences. The two kids that are screaming at each other may seem to be more violent, but they're really just having a boyfriend-girlfriend argument mm-hmm. in the way that they do in their neighborhood, mm-hmm. and they don't intend it to be anything beyond mm-hmm. that. But if you have a different cultural background that's more withheld, and it's like, right. People in my family do not raise their voices.
Mm-hmm.
If my mother raised her voice above even, you knew you were in serious trouble.
Mm-hmm.
And these kids are 15, 16 and going at each other but that's
part
of their experience. Mm-hmm. So there's understanding that. And then there's also racially tense situations mm-hmm. where kids are reacting because if it's a child of color where maybe there's been a perceived slight or an actual slight, or where, you know, a white person has had invaded space and there's been an unconscious reaction. How do you help educators develop the sensitivity and practice for those situations so that they can respond in the moment? Because in the moment, those
situations are charged
mm-hmm.
beyond what you think they might be, and they're hard to deal with.
Yeah. So one thing I like to consider is, like, for the adults, what do you want the outcome to be? Because you're the adult in the room. Even if they're bigger than you, whatever, you're the adult.
Bigger, louder.
Louder, right? You're the adult.
Teenagers have a way of being very full of bravado.
Yes, yes. So it's what is the outcome that you're looking for? If the outcome that you're looking for is for them to be removed from your class, then you're probably going to engage with them in a way that will not diffuse the situation. If the outcome is that you want them to get back to learning, then you're going to engage with them in a different way. So you know the student, there's a video that's a few years old now, I think it's about 3 years old, the student in South Carolina who was ripped from her chair over a cell phone. The SRO came into her classroom. I'll do the whole scenario.
Okay.
Student was on her phone. Teacher asked the student for her phone. She said no. Put it in her backpack. Teacher proceeded to ask the student for her phone. She continued to say no. Teacher called administrator. Administrator asked student for phone. Student said no. Administrator called police. Police came in, asked her for her phone. She said no. Then the police took her out of the desk, like body slammed her, arrested her, took her out of the room. Okay? In the beginning of the story, I said, teacher asked for her phone. She put it away. That should have been the end. Right? Because the outcome that you're looking for is for her to be connected to what you're doing, to be mm-hmm. engaged in her learning.
Right.
That's why you want her to put the phone away.
Mm.
By responding differently, it turned into a power struggle.
Mm-hmm.
And now you have to be right.
Mm-hmm.
So it escalates because it's a power struggle now. But the outcome happened immediately. She put the phone in her backpack. You wanted her to be off of her phone. Does it matter if it's in your possession? It shouldn't, because you want her to be connected to the learning. So we, as the adults, have to make the decision as to what we want the outcome to be. And then we align our response, not our reaction,
mm-hmm.
to what we want that outcome to be.
Great. So always paying attention to the outcome.
And not getting caught up in the moment. You know, like, we expect students to stay calm and blah, 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 blah. But when someone offends us, our adult reaction is to be upset, is to whatever. But we are surprised or taken aback, or, you know, shocked when a student has that same kind of response, when you have done something to slight them. They're humans too. They're people too. So we have to think about what is the end goal that we're looking for, because I'm the adult. I'm in charge in this classroom. And so now the teacher's been there, the assistant principal or principal's been there, and the RSO, now everyone's learning has been disrupted.
Right.
Over a 5 or 6 period, you know, 6 minute period of time. Now all the students are not getting what they need.
Mm-hmm.
But she put the phone away.
Mm-hmm. Great. They don't always put the phone away.
They don't always.
They don't put the phone away for me, but
they don't always.
I kick my battles.
And that's what you have to do.
Yeah.
You know, and the other piece is, if they don't put their phone away and you have a relationship with them, or if you don't have a relationship with them, use that as a place to start one. And don't call them out in front of everybody. When class is over, the session is over, ask to speak with them. Pull them aside and say, I asked you to put your phone away, and I felt disrespected when you didn't do that. And I left alone because there were other things that were prioritized for the day. But I don't disrespect you, and I would appreciate if you showed me that same courtesy. And I bet you would start seeing some different responses,
mm-hmm.
because you're treating them like a human and with respect.
Mm-hmm.
And so instead of you being an adversary, it's like, okay, miss,
Miss Amy or Miss whatever they call me. Right?
Right.
And you can get a different kind of response.
Great. So we've touched on this a little bit. A lot of the students in public school are kids of color.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of the teachers are not.
Mm-hmm.
And that's true in my nonprofit.
Mm-hmm.
And we're interested in moving towards, you know, creating some training that's accessible and inviting so that we can diversify our cohort.
Mm-hmm.
If you were speaking to that new cohort of trainees for a mindfulness program, mindfulness and developmental thinking, who are all teachers of color,
mm-hmm.
what would you say to them? Because I asked you what you would say to the teachers who were white. What would be the three things that you would want them to be aware of?
Mm-hmm. Ask, don't assume. just because we're the same color doesn't mean we're the same culture.
Mm-hmm.
Which goes back to ask, don't assume, right? Just because I'm a black woman doesn't mean my upbringing matches that of the students. So it's the same kind of projection. And be the example of who you see them being, the students. You as the adult, be the example as who you want them to be.
And why did you pull that out? Like, what are the things that you were thinking of?
I was thinking of the fact that many students of color have few people in their lives who are, that's not true. I'm going to retract that. In urban public school settings, there is often students of color who do not have the experience of having a model who has degrees beyond high school and beyond college.
Mm-hmm.
And so that discourse is not something that they're often or always engaged with. And so I would say you, if you are able to be a mindfulness instructor, right, then you have been to college, if they were teachers, if they're teachers, possibly. But you have expendable income, possibly. You have time. You have achieved something to get you into this space,
mm-hmm.
to be able to now be in this space.
Mm-hmm.
So share some of that. Share some of your journey. Be an example. Be a model so that they can see, because they can see themselves in you, and you can see yourselves in them. So let them see you, and you see them.
Mm. Great. And what would your advice be is as they're doing the training, if somebody like me or one of my instructors who looks like me is not aware of biases of privilege, and how would you, as a teacher trainee, maybe you don't have 35 years of mindfulness experience, especially if you're only 32.
Right.
But, you know, because a lot of these potential instructors will be younger, so they won't have the meditation experience.
Mm-hmm.
They won't understand those more, they won't just have invested the time in exploring perspectives and thought and nature of consciousness and human awareness. They might not have read the books on the brain science, but they're learning. But they may be more sensitive to some blindnesses around cultural privilege. So what would be your advice to these young people who are growing up in an environment that is pushing young people to have a voice, to claim space, to call out, to make known, to objectify all of these things, and how would you advise them to navigate that?
Oh, man. I think I would start with, if you can help it, try not to be too sensitive and don't take it all personal. Because remember, we're dealing with adolescents. And at some point, they're going to hate you. Period. It doesn't matter what you do. So try to not be overly sensitive, but learn from the essence of what it is they're trying to communicate. Because even if you don't have that deep training or experience, you can still hopefully unpack what a 16-year-old is trying to tell you. And so don't make it personal. Don't make it about you, and try to learn from it.
Mm-hmm. That's great. And what about if, as they're doing the training, they start feeling that?
Their pre-work training?
Yeah.
So I always say, you know, you're going to hit a growing edge. That's just part of this experience. And you need to be willing and ready to push through that. And remember that this space is safe. And so we all fumble and stumble. That's just part of life. And no one's going to be perfect at executing anything. So don't set yourself up to fail because you're not hitting the mark on the first try. Just keep working at it. That's what we have to do for everything. If you want to be an excellent teacher, you have to work at it. You want to be excellent at golf, you have to work at it. That's why everyone's not in the NBA. That's why everyone's not a professional golfer with green jackets. You know, we have to work at it. That everything that we do, when we want to be successful, we have to work at it.
Great. This is, I mean, we could talk for hours.
Yeah.
So I have one last question, okay. Really two parts. I'll make it into two. What if you were to pull out one book or movie that you've seen or read recently or in the last year that you felt was really important or really inspiring?
Yes. Dick Gregory's Defining Moments in Black Crossed Out History.
Awesome.
Mm-hmm. Because Black history is history.
Mm-hmm.
Period. And he passed recently, and I had the opportunity to see him a couple years ago, and he is dynamic, and he is what I describe as a truth seeker.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the book is from his perspective, but I learned so many things because he was 80-something years old and had been part of a civil rights movement since he was in his teens and 20s. So he had this vast experience of traveling the world, of meeting all these different people. And I just learned so much about things that are embedded in our history that came from Black folks.
Beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
That's a great, great suggestion.
Mm-hmm. I love that book.
And last question. So in this time where it's a challenging time, and the cell phones are a real blessing in being able to document a lot of atrocities and inequities, but it puts it all in everyone's face,
mm-hmm.
So it's hard. The public discourse is inflamed right now, mm-hmm. in ways that it wasn't 10 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
What keeps you inspired?
Oh, that this is just the beginning of the revolution, basically. There has to be this time for things to really change. And if you look at, like, historical patterns, there's something like this kind of tension and space that always leads to some sort of movement. And right now, I think we have several movements kind of working tangentially, and I'm really hoping that we can start connecting this, because this is about justice for all people, and we can't just make it about women, and we can't just make it about people of color, and we can't just make it about immigration, and we can't just make it about gun violence. It's about all of these things. It can't just be about gay rights. It has to be all of these things, because as long as there's a system in place that is perpetuating oppression for anybody, then we're all experiencing that oppression in some way.